Hello there. Today is Thursday, June 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Democrats and Republicans come out in unity after a shooting targeted at lawmakers.
We're all imperfect, but we do not shed our humanity when we enter this chamber. For all the noise and all the fury, we are one family.
A London high-rise still smoldering as officials look for answers to the deadly blaze. A U.S. strategy in Afghanistan, Congress wants answers. Also ahead, another amazing health benefit of broccoli. It's all on today's International Edition. A hospital in Washington, D.C. says the Republican congressman shot and wounded early Wednesday at a congressional baseball practice is in critical condition following surgery. Representative Steve Scalise of Louisiana was shot in the hip on the baseball field in Alexandria, Virginia, across from the river from Washington. President Donald Trump visited Scalise Wednesday night at the hospital where he's being treated. He said the shootings are a reminder for all citizens to overcome the political polarization that's gripped Washington and the rest of the nation.
We may have our differences, but we do well in times like these to remember that everyone who serves in our nation's capital is here because, above all, they love our country.
Besides Scalise, a Capitol Police officer, a congressional aide, and a lobbyist were wounded by the attacker, with a handgun and a rifle fired on Republican lawmakers practicing for a charity baseball game scheduled to take place Thursday in the nation's capital. There were about 20 congressmen on the field. They hit the ground or ducked behind trees and shelters when the shooter opened fire, apparently without warning. Afterward, in a rare plea for unity, House Speaker Paul Ryan said an attack on one is an attack on all.
Before this House returns to its business, let's just slow down and reflect, to think about how we're all being tested right now, because we are being tested right now. I ask each of you to join me to resolve to come together, to lift each other up, and to show the country, to show the world, that we are one house, the people's house, united in our humanity. It is that humanity which will win the day, and it always will.
And House Minority Leader Democrat Nancy Pelosi shared the sentiment.
To my colleagues, you're going to hear me say something you've never heard me say before. I identify myself with the remarks of the speaker. They're beautiful remarks, Mr. Speaker. Thank you so much for the sentiments that they represent. Thank you so much.
Well, the gunman, 66-year-old James Hodgkinson of Belleville, Illinois, was wounded by Capitol Police and later died. He fired repeatedly at the men on the ball field before police were able to return fire. Now, authorities say there's no clear motive yet. Some of Hodgkinson's social media posts, though, bitterly lashed out at President Trump. Hodgkinson was also a volunteer with Senator Bernie Sanders' Democratic presidential campaign. Sanders was quick to condemn the shooter's actions.
I am sickened by this despicable act, and let me be as clear as I can be. Violence of any kind is unacceptable in our society, and I condemn this action in the strongest possible terms.
Well, the lawmakers were in high praise of Capitol and Alexandria police. They say without them, there could have been a bloodbath. The managers of the Democratic and Republican charity baseball teams say Thursday's charity baseball game will go on as scheduled. Thursday's game, set for Nationals Park, the home of the city's professional baseball team, has become a Washington summertime fixture, a chance for lawmakers to have some fun away from the political barbs they trade day after day. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Four people were killed, including the gunman, in a San Francisco UPS facility shooting. The U.S. Senate approves an amendment of new rounds of Russia sanctions. The Trump administration amends travel ban date to keep the legal battle alive. And 3D technology is moving into the music world. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The United States is not winning in Afghanistan. That's according to the U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis, who testified before lawmakers during a Defense Department budget hearing Tuesday. After nearly 6 months in power, the Trump administration is still working on a new plan for how to stabilize Afghanistan. Tuesday, members of the U.S. Senate Armed Services Committee let top Pentagon leaders know that after 16 years of war, they are sick of waiting. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb reports.
After nearly 5 months in power, the Trump administration is still working on a new plan for how to stabilize Afghanistan. Tuesday, members of the U.S. Senate Armed Services Committee let top Pentagon leaders know they are sick of waiting.
We want a strategy, and I don't think that's a hell of a lot to ask.
By mid-July, we'll be able to brief you in detail, sir. We're putting it together now, and there are actions being taken to make certain that we don't pay a price for the delay.
200 meters to the east.
Secretary Mattis said the U.S. was drawing strength from allies as part of the plan, which takes time. There are about 13,000 NATO troops in Afghanistan. Sending more is under consideration. He said the defense team needs to alter the current strategy, which officials agree have placed the war-torn country in a stalemate against the Afghan Taliban.
We're not winning in Afghanistan right now, and we will correct this as soon as possible.
Mattis defined winning in Afghanistan as when the Afghan government is strong enough to drive down enemy violence to a manageable level for local security forces to handle. He said that will require a residual force of American and allied troops who would train Afghans while maintaining high-end security capabilities. Carla Babb, VOA News, the Pentagon.
Well, firefighters in London continue to go through the rubble of the city's biggest fire disaster in recent memory. Police say at least 12 people were killed as the rapidly moving blaze raced through a 24-story apartment building in West London in the pre-dawn hours Wednesday, trapping some residents. International Edition's Sarah Williams gets an update from VOA London correspondent Luis Ramirez.
Rescue crews are still in what they're calling a search and rescue mode. This is happening as big questions are coming up. The grief is turning to anger in the city because people are asking, those who survived this fire, asking not only how did it start, but why did it spread so fast? We're talking about a 24-story tower that was recently renovated. Britain has some of the world's most stringent fire codes. That's because of history. And so there are big questions on what went wrong here.
Who lives in this building?
Well, the North Kensington area is a densely populated area that's very diverse, multi-ethnic, and that's pretty much the demographic of this tower, about 120 apartments there, a real mix of elderly people, immigrants, people of all religions. It really is a microcosm of London. Many families living there. Some of the most poignant pictures that we've seen is of children being evacuated from there, reports of a mother having to throw her child from the window, that we have reports that the child is okay. Very, very poignant scenes, but ultimately a very, very mixed community.
Have they been able to get enough emergency personnel to respond to this?
Well, yes, the response was quite impressive. In fact, firefighters turned up at the scene within 6 minutes of the first call. And so right away, it was very clear this was an extremely serious situation. And the London firefighters showed up at 200 of them in the initial moments. They've stayed on the task, but this is a very, very difficult situation, such a large building, and the fire having spread so quickly. some of the questions are coming up is why exactly did it spread so quickly? Some of the residents are expressing anger that they said a lot of them did not hear any fire alarms whatsoever. Some said they heard fire alarms, but very far away. There were no sprinklers going off. And then there was also the issue of the old instruction people get when you're in a high rise and a fire breaks out, and stay put, don't try to go anywhere. And that, for a lot of people, tragically, did not work this time.
And I can imagine a number of people are being treated at hospitals. I've also heard stories about the community around is trying to help people that have been affected by this fire.
Yes, certainly all area hospitals, five of them, got ready very quickly and took in the scores of people who were injured, with everything from smoke inhalation to other injuries resulting from a very rapid evacuation. At last count, there were 74 people and 20 of them in critical condition. We have seen an outpouring of kindness in this neighborhood, where people tend to get along very well, people opening their homes for those who've been displaced. Charitable organizations are also out in force helping, trying to find temporary housing, providing emergency cash, and just otherwise trying to take care of people who have suddenly been left homeless. We're seeing churches opening their doors, mosques opening their doors to help.
All right, that's VOA's Luis Ramirez in London. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, since former President Barack Obama and Cuban President Raul Castro began the process of normalizing ties in 2015, the communist island nation has seen a boom in tourism from the United States. An official Cuban website says some 300,000 Americans flocked to Cuba in the first 5 months of 2017. Those just-released figures from Havana come days ahead of President Trump's expected shift in Cuba policy. Trump is reportedly set to announce on Friday steps to reverse some of the changes made by Obama to open commerce and travel after a half-century standoff. Joining me now is London-based journalist Amy Gutman, who has done extensive reporting on Cuba and was actually surprised to find Americans receiving medical treatments in Cuba unavailable to them in the U.S. Amy, thanks for being with us. So first of all, what changes have you seen since the lightened restrictions?
Cubans, Cuban Americans, and people abroad were trying very hard to hold back from a "this is a great gold rush" kind of mentality. You can imagine everyone was jumping on board here to try to benefit. U.S. airlines were all instituting flights when the opening was first announced, and every one of them was applying to the FAA to win the air rights. There were tens of flights every day from at least a dozen American cities going to Havana. Hotels are doing very well in Havana, and that's largely because there was so much investment needed. So the infrastructure was there, but the refurbishments hadn't occurred. Now that the investment is available, tourism is doing okay in country. But I think U.S. airlines were really surprised that demand was not higher.
Any explanation for it?
It still hasn't been easy to go to Cuba. It's not that easy to make your own plans. A lot of things still need to be booked through local operators. You know, if you find the right person, it can work beautifully. If you don't, it can be a real headache, which is sort of just an everyday occurrence in Cuba. Things are still very difficult. Until recently, it was very difficult to communicate even via email.
So President Obama, there were certain restrictions. It wasn't like a free-for-all. Everybody can just hop on a plane. There were certain reasons you could have for going to Cuba. And one of them you've done a lot of research on, and that is for medical treatment.
That's right. That's one of the benefits of the Obama policies that have occurred, you know, since his visit there, which is that one of the reasons that Americans can legitimately travel to Cuba, and this is still in existence, is for medical reasons. And I met an American man who lives in Wisconsin who started going to Cuba about 6 years ago for a lung cancer treatment. It's called a vaccine, but it's a therapeutic vaccine. It's used as a vaccine to ward off the return of cancer, so to keep him in remission. But actually, the Roswell Park Cancer Institute in Buffalo, New York, they are applying for funding to run trials on a preventive vaccine for lung cancer to be used in high-risk patients. They have fought for 4 years to get approval through various U.S. government agencies, including the FDA, to run trials of this drug. They've been collaborating with their colleagues in Cuba. It is now finally legal for them to do so under these policies that Obama announced late last year, which officially allowed for this collaboration between U.S. and Cuban medical researchers. It also made it legal for Americans to sponsor medical research in Cuba. This cancer patient that I met from Wisconsin, he goes once a year to Havana. He carries back with him a $5,000 annual supply of drugs that he needs to keep him well and cancer-free. This is a stage 4 lung cancer patient, small cell lung cancer. He was diagnosed more than 7 years ago. He went into remission more than 6 years ago. He was told that he would have maybe 5 years to live at best. And this is now 7 years later, and he's still alive.
I guess I'm curious as to why Cuba has cancer treatments that are not currently available to the U.S.
Cuba seems like one of the most unlikely places to come up with a treatment for lung cancer or any cancer. But the irony here is that after U.S. sanctions prevented the Cubans from accessing American pharmaceuticals, former President Fidel Castro decided that he was going to invest billions in preventive care, in health care, which of course is provided free to every Cuban. And he set up some 13 scientific institutions specifically to work on vaccines. And so they have come up with the world's first cholera vaccine. They have come up with other vaccines. They are working on other cancer drugs. This is just one of many. And by the way, this particular drug, which is called Cimavax, Roswell Park Cancer Institute in the U.S., in Buffalo, is testing not just Cimavax on its own because they do believe in its efficacy, but they're most interested in combining it with other therapies to see how it can be used to potentially treat other cancers like breast cancer, prostate cancer, head and neck cancer, you name it. They really see potential here. But B, the cost is much cheaper. So in Cuba, this drug costs about $1 per dose.
What happens when President Trump rolls back some of President Obama's Cuba policies? Will that impact people trying to get to Cuba for any of these treatments?
That's not known at the moment. There's been nothing out there to suggest that he's going to roll back the medical policies. Ironically, the patient that I met was a Trump voter. So he said that while he voted for Trump, he was quite sincere in his hope that President Trump would not roll back any policies that could impact these medical collaborations or the ability for others to travel for medical reasons.
All right. London-based journalist Amy Gutman, thanks so much for the insights. We appreciate it. Turning now to what's trending on social media, what's happening, Andrew Palchevsky?
Well, Lori London, we talk a lot on the show about Facebook, so let's give Twitter some love today.
Okay.
With two Twitter stories, starting with a nice birthday greeting that was a little misconstrued and caused a little bit of confusion on Twitter. June 14th was Donald Trump's birthday. The president turned 71 years old. And, of course, he is a prolific tweeter. It is his favorite method of communication. So Twitter decided to mark his birthday by putting balloon animations on his profile. If you visited his Twitter account, you would see those little balloons were going to float up to the top. People a little confused about this, wondering why there were balloons on his page, not realizing it was his birthday. People wondering if Donald Trump actually put the balloons there and very confused about why he did that. And then in light of the shooting in Alexandria, Virginia, people saying it was in poor taste for those balloons to be there. But they did remain up there all day Wednesday as Twitter's way of saying happy birthday, Mr. President.
I'm sure there was no harm intended.
Yes, it was a nice gesture, but a little bit misconstrued, much like the next story about Twitter. We talked about the shooting in Alexandria that happened on Wednesday. There was the fire in London, another mass shooting in the state of California that left several people dead. So a lot of very heavy stories going on. So what was trending as the top trend on Twitter on Wednesday? Hashtag Happy Death Day. The reason why this was trending, it was a promoted hashtag as part of a movie called Happy Death Day that is coming out. So the promoters of that movie paid to have this hashtag appear at the top of the list. However, with all of the events that were going on and the people being killed and people saying it was very poor taste. Again, another instance where it was not intentional. It just happened to be a case of poor timing. They did ultimately remove that hashtag from the trending list after these events went on. So Twitter did notice that it was perhaps not the best idea to have that hashtag up there, even though it was a paid promoted one. No word yet from Twitter apologizing, but I imagine that they'll issue something like that in the coming days, saying it was unintentional, saying they couldn't predict the news, they didn't know it was going to happen, and they addressed it very quickly.
All right. Thank you so much, Andrew. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, a compound found in broccoli appears to be at least as effective as a widely used drug to treat diabetes, according to Swedish researchers, who think the ingredient could be a safe alternative for lowering blood sugar, even though some people don't care for the vegetable. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
While former First Lady Michelle Obama made it her mission to encourage Americans to eat more vegetables, back in 1990, then-President George H.W. Bush put his fork down when it came to one vegetable in particular.
I do not like broccoli, and I haven't liked it since I was a little kid, and my mother made me eat it, and I'm President of the United States, and I'm not going to eat any more broccoli.
But the latest study of broccoli could have changed Mr. Bush's mind. The vegetable contains an agent called sulforaphane that appears in clinical trials to work as well as metformin at reducing blood sugar levels in diabetics. That could be good news for a significant percentage of the 300 million type 2 diabetics around the world who cannot take metformin, a first-line therapy, because of potential damage to the kidneys and stomach upset. Dr. Anders Rosengren of the Lund University Diabetes Center in Sweden discovered the potential of sulforaphane in lowering HbA1c, a blood biomarker of long-term glucose control. He led a team of researchers who used a computer model to sort through a public database of more than 3,800 promising compounds to find sulforaphane.
This is very exciting because there have been so many claims over the years of different food dietary components having different health effects. But here we have really scientifically based proof of that it has an effect on type 2 diabetes.
In a 12-week study of 97 patients with type 2 diabetes, sulforaphane lowered HbA1c levels by a relative reduction of 10% over the control group. Because it would be unethical not to treat patients with a known blood sugar-lowering drug, Rosengren says all of the participants in the study were on metformin, including the ones who got sulforaphane. The findings were published in the journal Science Translational Medicine. Rosengren looks forward to conducting another trial with pre-diabetic patients.
If you would have people without metformin at all, it might be that the sulforaphane effect might be even stronger.
Before you go eating broccoli with an eye toward reducing your blood sugar, Rosengren says average portions of the cruciferous vegetable would not be enough. In the study, researchers gave subjects up to 5 kilograms of sulforaphane extract, an amount that would be difficult to consume in a day, except in pill form. For diabetics who hate broccoli, that could be an answer to their dilemma. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Under its Rewards for Justice program, the U.S. State Department has announced it is increasing to $25 million its reward offer for information leading to the location, arrest, or conviction of ISIL leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, also known as Ibrahim Awad Ibrahim Ali al-Badri and Abu Dua. Al-Baghdadi is the senior leader of the terrorist organization, the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, also known as ISIL or Daesh. Protecting the homeland and the American people is the top counterterrorism priority for the United States. Just as military efforts have been intensified against ISIL, the United States is increasing the means available to gain information on ISIL leadership and bring them to justice. In June 2014, ISIL seized control of portions of Syria and Iraq, self-declared a so-called Islamic caliphate, and named al-Baghdadi as caliph. In recent years, ISIL has gained the allegiance of jihadist groups and radicalized individuals around the world, and has inspired terrorist attacks in the United States. Under al-Baghdadi, ISIL has been responsible for the deaths of thousands of civilians in the Middle East, including the brutal murder of numerous civilian hostages from Japan, the United Kingdom, and the United States. The group also has enabled or directed terrorist attacks beyond the borders of its self-declared caliphate. In 2011, the United States named Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi a specially designated global terrorist under Executive Order 13224. He was also sanctioned by the United Nations Security Council, ISIL Al-Qaeda Sanctions Committee. At that time, al-Baghdadi was the leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq, which ultimately morphed into ISIL. If you have information on Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, contact the Rewards for Justice office via email at no2daesh@rewards4justice.co, by phone at 1-800-877-3927, or by mail at Rewards for Justice, Washington, D.C., 20520-0303, USA. All information will be kept strictly confidential. Since its inception in 1984, the Rewards for Justice program has paid in excess of $125 million to more than 80 people who provided actionable information that helped bring terrorists to justice or prevented acts of international terrorism worldwide. You can follow the Rewards for Justice program on Twitter at twitter.com/rewards4justice.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.